From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss Russia's ouster from the Group of Eight Industrialized Nations, and I'll talk with Joshua Landis about the murder convictions of more than 500 supporters of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi.
Many of the liberals and many of the young people who welcomed in this military dictatorship, thinking it would protect their freedoms of speech and other things, are now beginning to regret it.
And later, a conversation with political scientist Fevzi Bilgin about allegations against Turkey's prime minister.
Serious bribes for government members, money laundering, even just one of these charges would be enough to get the government down in a normal democracy.
Political instability in Turkey ahead of Sunday's local elections. The news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis. There's much international news this week as usual. And really a big deal this week, Rebecca, that Russia was kicked out of the G8. They were going back to the original G7, the group of seven, the most industrialized countries in the world. Obviously, this is a result of Russia's annexation of Crimea. The Germans seem to have some reservations, but the rest definitely not. They're now moving their planned meeting that was going to be in Sochi in June is now moving to Brussels. I mean, is this likely really to have an effect on Russia? Obviously, they're being punished, but what's this going to do? What is it going to accomplish?
This is primarily symbolic. The group of industrial countries, as you mentioned, the G8, now the G7, is not necessarily all that powerful anymore. So this is a group of countries, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United States, of course, and the UK. But more importantly now is actually the G20, which includes countries like Russia, China, and India, these growing economies. They are absolutely not going to kick Russia out of the G20, and that's where economic power and these discussions in the international market are going to take place. So it's predominantly symbolic. It's pretty much a universal decision by the G7, but it's not likely to have any long-term effects.
So obviously sending a strong message, but it has to be paired with other things, right? I mean, if they're not going to be kicked out of these other forums, if it's not going to be paired with really strong sanctions that are multilateral and consistent, I mean, there's really not going to be much of a result here, other than the fact that Russia does become more and more isolated from the Western world, from the world's most powerful and rich nations?
They become isolated in that regard, but again, they're not going to be isolated from these growing economies. And the United States and Europe have to be very, very careful about these sanctions. That's why the sanctions so far have been fairly light. They will likely increase. That's part of the discussion going on right now. But of course, the Western world trades a great deal with Russia. Russia is now integrated into the international market. And so if the sanctions are too heavy, they are very likely to negatively affect the United States and Europe as well. So it's a very difficult balancing act there.
Well, we've seen the stock market in Russia waffle a little bit in recent days. But what's going on with the German reservations? Why are the Germans a little slow to get on board here?
Well, again, they don't want to set the precedent. And again, Germany is a country that is very reliant on Russia, particularly for gas. We often think of the Eastern European countries as being reliant on them. But in 2010, I believe it was, almost 40% of Germany's natural gas came from Russia. So they are very concerned about that.
So obviously those relations do matter. Those bilateral relations do matter.
Absolutely.
In this case. So, okay, Joshua, over to you and back to the Middle East. Interesting news out of Egypt, a little disturbing news out of Egypt this week. More than 500 members and supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood were sentenced to death for attacking a police department and killing a police officer and damaging property, I guess. There was this court proceeding that lasted
2 days.
I mean, very short period of time.
Defense lawyers were not there. I mean, it has taken everybody's breath away. And people who had said, oh, we're going back to Mubarak's time, are now saying, this is not going back to Mubarak's time. This is going back to Nasser in the 1950s when he cracked down the Muslim Brotherhood. Many were tortured in the jails. But clearly, Sisi is sending a very dramatic message. And he has arrested many. He's impounded their money. He has really trying to uproot the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's not stopping. So the whole world has really had their breath taken away by this. At how far will he go? And he's just now thrown in his hat for presidential elections. So clearly, Egypt is consolidating this new military dictatorship.
We've got another 700 that have been arrested and are on trial, in addition to these more than 500 that have been convicted. But it seems to me, I don't know, revolution doesn't necessarily lead to progress in this case. I mean, like you said, they're going backwards. They're going back to Nasser's time. Is this just a new era of repression in Egypt, or are they going to get over some sort of hump where they're going to move forward in some democratic way?
Many of the liberals and many of the young people who welcomed in this military dictatorship, thinking it would protect their freedoms of speech and other things, are now beginning to regret. You look at Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. People are beginning to attack it. So the pendulum is swinging. A lot of people are saying this is just a hiccup in this revolutionary process, and that we're mid-road. So we don't know how long this will last and whether Egypt will shudder and move towards greater instability in the future, or whether they can consolidate their hold and keep the lid on Egypt for the next decade or so. We don't know.
Well, clearly these actions are being condemned around the world as massive human rights violations. I mean, even the widowed wife of the police officer that was killed was dissatisfied with this conviction, you know, expressed doubt about the fact that there were this many people convicted for the murder of her husband. So, you know, what are we to expect in terms of Egypt's reconnection with the international community if there are nothing but condemnations about their behavior?
It's odd because Washington officials have continued to talk about Egypt moving towards democracy and the democratizing process. They've tried still not to call this a coup d'etat that happened by the military because they would have to withdraw their aid. And Washington's sticking to its old narrative of, well, Egypt is democratizing. So everybody is flummoxed. They don't know how to deal with this. They're condemning it, and yet they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, Rebecca, Joshua, thank you so much, as always, for your insight.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment for me or any of our panelists, let us know in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can also send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Grolot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up, Rebecca and Joshua talk with political scientist Fevzi Bilgin from the Rethink Institute in Washington, D.C., about instability in Turkey ahead of Sunday's local elections. I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Turkey's main opposition party recalled parliament this week for an extraordinary session to discuss allegations of corruption against Prime Minister Erdogan's government ahead of Sunday's local elections. And on Wednesday, a Turkish court ordered the telecommunications authority to restore the country's access to Twitter, 5 days after the government blocked the social network. Erdogan had threatened to rip out the roots of Twitter in Turkey after users posted links to recordings suggesting corruption within his administration. On Thursday, that government crackdown on social media spread to YouTube. Fevzi Bilgin is a political scientist at the Rethink Institute in Washington and detailed the allegations during a conversation with Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz.
Fevzi Bilgin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you are an expert on Turkish politics, and there's certainly a lot going on in Turkey right now in this last year and beyond. But most recently, we've been hearing a great deal about the corruption charges. So maybe you could give our listeners kind of a sum up of what's going on with these charges.
December 17 was a milestone in Turkish politics. On that day, Istanbul prosecutors launched an investigation, a very wide-ranging investigation towards cabinet ministers, businessmen close to Mr. Tayyip Erdogan himself. Among the allegations are corruption involving billions of dollars, serious bribes for government members, money laundering through international businessmen, and cabinet members or government bureaucrats getting their kickbacks from those operations. So normally, even just one of these charges would be enough to get the government down in a normal democracy.
Let me stop you for a second and try to go to the larger picture. The Prime Minister, Erdogan, has been a superman of Turkish politics, served two terms. He's changed a great deal in Turkey. His AK Party has won more and more seats each election. He tries to do something like Putin, move from being prime minister. He's constrained by the Constitution to two terms as prime minister, but he wants to become president. In order to do that, he has to change the Constitution To what extent were the demonstrations that broke out this summer before all these corruption charges linked to this attempt to continue on as the real power broker in Turkey? And what were the people so upset about this summer when they began to demonstrate?
Yes. Let me start for that specific event and then, you know, let's try to magnify, look, zoom out and see what is the real problem behind all this. Gezi protests started as part of a, like an environmental campaign to protect the park. And then because of unreasonable police reaction and some of the statements made by the prime minister himself, people were very much agitated, and then tens of thousands of people took the street to support the protesters. And then the protests spread all across the country and turned it into some sort of a, like a, you know, social opposition against AKP and Erdogan. And it was not about Gezi Park anymore. And if you ask what was this about, why did it become like that, I think we have to probably go back to, 2 years or so in Turkish history, because, you know, in 2011, after the victory of parliamentary elections by Mr. Erdogan, in the winter of 2011, his approval rate was hovering like above 70%. That was a very good rate. So apparently he was doing things right. He promised to reconcile with Kurdish demands. There was a new and exciting spirit about the new possible new constitution to be written, drafted. And the country's economy was doing great. So all these things basically contributed to this great, positive mood in the country. But then he started to do things that prevented these things from happening. Apparently, there's a very strong and obvious consolidation of power by him in party and generally in government. In the past, AKP was a party of consultation, so to speak. Erdogan was still the leader, but there were number two, number three, number four people that could challenge him. But after 2011, that was not possible anymore. And not only that, the link between the leadership and the party in general was lost. After these, in last 2 years or so, a small coterie of government bureaucrats, advisors, and so on, that can amount to like maybe 30, 40, 50 people, formed around Erdogan and insulated him from not only from critics, but also from like internal voices within the party. So these people were much more decisive in terms of determining policies.
Say he was becoming a dictator, or is that too strong?
The trend may end up there, but this is more of a worrying consolidation of power, a trend for authoritarianism within still a good deal of electoral democracy. But it's too early to call him a dictator.
Political scientist Fevzi Bilgin speaking with Worldviews contributors Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis. We'll hear more of their conversation right after this short break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to our conversation with political scientist Fevzi Bilgin, the executive director of the Rethink Institute in Washington, D.C. He's discussing allegations of political corruption in Turkey that could play a role in the outcome of Sunday's local elections with Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis.
Do you think his government can survive this turmoil? The opposition parties are saying he has to resign. It's ineluctable.
Yes.
That he can't escape it, and it's just a matter of time.
Yes.
All of the hawks are circling, in a sense. The vultures are circling. And he is going to lead his party and Turkey to a terrible demise unless he moves out of the way. Is that true, or is that just rhetoric from the opposition?
No, it's true. The charges are so serious. And the amounts are so enormous. This is the greatest corruption case in the history of Turkey. We have seen really some serious corruption cases that led to demise of CHP-MHP coalitions in the 90s. 90s was like, it was a lost decade for Turkey. And it was all about corruption. But the country has never seen this much. And the fact that it's coming from a very successful government, a very, very popular government, that was a shocker. I think AKP is still in disbelief, and they don't want to believe that they close their ears to all sorts of like news and statements and so on. They just don't want to believe it. So normally, I think the charges were enough to get the government collapse. And they should have resigned at the time. But the election will be decisive now. And basically Erdogan took the election road and he said that, well, first I want to go to election and see what the people think about that. And then we'll decide what to do.
Now, some of his supporters are saying that there is a plot, there is a conspiracy, and they're saying that this is being waged by the Gulenist, an opposition to him right now. Can you tell us a little bit about who this group is and if there is potentially any truth to this this targeting of him and his party?
Yes. Well, the Gulen movement originated in like 1970s, and this is around converged around Mr. Fethullah Gulen, who was a Muslim cleric in Turkey.
Who actually lives in the United States?
Now he lives, yes. He used to live in Turkey. He was, compared to other contemporary leaders, he was much more moderate, and he basically encouraged his friends to focus on education, focus on kind of like keeping dialogue with seculars and that sort of thing. And 70s was a very challenging decade for Turkey. That was like a chaotic situation, basically. By the 90s, because of the military rule and everything was kind of quiet. And in the 90s, he came out publicly, and the movement came out publicly, basically promoting an agenda that Islam and democracy can harmonize, can work together. So there should not be going back from democracy, as Turkey being the most democratic country in the Muslim world at the time, or with most democratic experience, yes. And, at the time, Mr. Erdogan and his predecessors, like Erbakan and so on, they were coming from political Islamist background. They were Islamists. They were looking for an Islamic state with different names subscribe to more top-down approach to change, transform the society. And Mr. Gulen was adamantly against it. But then the military intervention in 1997 basically attacked both sides, Mr. Gulen had to leave for the United States, and the Islamists lost their party. It was banned from politics, and Erdogan served some time in jail. Then Erdogan emerged out of jail as a Democrat. He said that, I'm a Muslim Democrat. I throw off my Islamist garb. Now I'm a new person. And increasingly subscribed to the discourse that was developed by Mr. Gulen himself as a more conservative, democratic discourse that created this Muslim democracy notion and strong subscription to EU membership, a strong subscription to democratization reforms, civilian constitution, and civilian control of the military. These were pinnacles, important kind of sides of the new discourse. So there were some convergence of values between AKP and the movement. Movement is a social movement, by the way. It's not a political party. It doesn't have a political party. It has a vocal media. It has a lot of educational institutions in Turkey. So in that respect, there is a considerable social influence that it has. And this social base was happy to support AKP in the elections. But nonetheless, there was no organic relation or something between the two. And in last 2-3 years, as AKP effectively beaten all his rivals, and then even co-opting other conservative political leaders, so the only thing left against Erdogan's on the Erdogan's way was Gulen movement, which was resisting to co-option and which cannot be bought, apparently. And because of the media, because of the social base, the movement was increasingly critical of Erdogan for abandoning the democratic discourse, the policies, and moving more into Middle East, moving more into East, to Russia, China, and so on, moving country away from the European Union. So that's how it started. There was tension between the two since then. during the Gezi protest, movement was not very vocally supporting the protest, but they were not against it either. Even Mr. Gulen at some point of time criticized Mr. Erdogan for calling them looters. Okay, he said that this is not the right way to approach this and so on. There's no need to agitate people. So that didn't work well. And when we came to all the way to November, there was now an overt assault by the government against Gulen movement educational institutions in Turkey. And finally, when this whole investigation kind of popped up, I think Erdogan and his friends thought that this is a great opportunity, by the way, to get on these guys too. So they chose the movement as a scapegoat and relentlessly attacking and portraying it as a fifth column that is effectively managed by U.S. or Israeli interest.
As a last word,
yes.
Can I ask you, mm-hmm. are you hopeful? Turkey has been a symbol of democracy
yes.
and progress
mm-hmm.
in the Islamic world. Are you hopeful that that's going to be fulfilled, or is Turkey going to see another lost decade, as you said before?
Yes. Well, I am hopeful. I'm hopeful, and I'm going to tell you why. The trend, the political trend, social trend in Turkey in the last 30 years, it was towards more democratic, more plural society. And if you look at some of the developments, for example, these aggressive form of secularism in the form of Kemalism is pretty much marginalized in the last 10 years. People were not happy about the way that government treat the Kurdish minority or other non-Muslim minority and so on. There have been great changes in that areas. And AKP won three elections one after another just because they basically subscribed to these notions. And now they are battling with this trend. And this trend so far has beaten all the adversaries. It seems like it's a very strong trend. And I'm hopeful that in that respect, the people's demands, people's democratic spirit and this trend will take over. But that may take a while. I am not expecting an overnight change. It may take 1 to 2 years to settle all the issues in Turkey.
Well, I guess we'll wait and see how these elections turn out.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz's conversation with political scientist Fevzi Bilgin. We have more information on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Nick Aguilera serves as our research and digital intern this semester, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gralat.